In this episode, we interviewed Tony Tadich. As a kid, Tony grew up in his dad's shop, working part-time before heading off to college. When he returned home at the age of 20, he had a choice to make in his career between law enforcement and auto repair. His decision to follow in his dad's footsteps opened up a path he never dreamed. Today, Tony and his family have 5 shops. And on the way to becoming an MSO, Tony experienced some really tough challenges. He walks us through them and gives us a behind-the-scenes look at what it took to turn things around, including how to find the right people, how to work with family, and the value of simplicity when growing. You experienced something with that first store that was pretty catastrophic.
We lost almost $250,000 in business ourselves that first year. That conversation came down basically through me getting served with foreclosure paperwork.
I got to brag on Tony. There's been several instances where Tony has all of a sudden found himself on the edge of a cliff and he stepped up to the challenge every single time. Going MSO is like getting drunk in a lot of ways. In that, you know,
for a guy who drinks Sprite, this is a shocking revelation right now.
It is.
I don't do a lot of things flashy. You'll see me go from 0 to 100 miles an hour real fast. I'm gonna plow through things and I'm gonna constantly go forever. I think that goes back to my one superpower, which is consistency.
I often say pain necessitates change. Are you gonna wait until it's painful enough for you to change? Do you know that your shop has another gear, but you just can't find it? ShopFix Academy has the largest community of like-minded business professionals to help you find that next gear. You get coaching, community, and personal development. So here's my challenge to you. Call ShopFix. Try them out. Don't take my word for it. Find out for yourself. I know firsthand what they can do. I've seen the businesses turn around. I've talked to the owners whose lives have changed, whose families are doing better today than they were before. Call 615-645-3683. Take this challenge as an opportunity to find out for yourself. Imagine where you could be after 12, 24, 36 months from now. You can be in a completely better place, or you can wait, let another year go by. Pain necessitates change. Call 615-645-3683 and let them know we sent you. Call ShopFix. I'm amazed how many shops out there are not taking advantage of digital marketing. Using a digital marketing partner is your key to effortlessly increasing car count. And notice I said partner, not vendor. Finding an experienced partner who works with you makes all the difference. A partner gets to know you and what your business needs, not just apply a template and send you a bill and call it a day. Leads Near Me is a partner you need. And yes, they have experience managing over $16 million in ad revenue, specifically in auto repair. But what's even more impressive is how they work with you. If you go to their website, leadsnearme.com, they host a ton of videos and podcast content for you to get to know them personally. Or call them at 888-953-2379 and find out how they can partner with you. Again, that's 888-953-2379. Leads Near Me, effortlessly increasing car count. You're listening to the Success Leaves Clues podcast, a podcast for the auto repair industry, where we uncover the journey of real shop owners. We hear their story of what it took to get their breakthrough, because we are here to inspire you to have your own breakthrough, to be the success you've been looking for, and to change your industry, your family, and your life forever. Thank you for joining us, and now on to the episode. Tony, thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me on the podcast.
You know, there's several places we can go with this to get started, but I'm actually curious about how you got started and why you chose auto repair. You know, you came back home, you had a couple choices to make in your life that really could define your journey. Why'd you choose auto repair?
The choice really came down to obviously what I was comfortable with, but I really thought about this. I had the stress level probably the same being an entrepreneur or being a police officer. The divorce rate, the mental health issues, that type of stuff of a police officer still are probably much worse than they are of an entrepreneur, even though entrepreneurs do battle a lot of mental health stuff and everything. But what I really found out was the income level and what I could provide for my family and what I could provide for others around me. That really struck the passion chord for me. And that was the entrepreneur side. going down the auto repair side and going down what I always had grown up around and loved. And, you know, for me, it's really being able to provide people with opportunity that I had, that I was born into, kind of being born into automotive repair. And that's been hugely important to me and been one of my driving forces.
And I know your dad, he got into shops, what, early 80s, and, you know, you were working in his shops, you were seeing him working auto repair. And I think you said he was kind of a serial entrepreneur, being a car salesman and all. Did he have an impact on your life? What kind of input did he have into your choices or really moving into that industry?
You know, my dad, especially through adulthood now, has become my number one mentor, my best friend, my confidant. He's probably the person that I'm the tightest with next to my wife. And yeah, I mean, my dad has impact every single day of my life. And that's probably one of the coolest things about the partnership that we have. And I hear so many stories of father sons and father daughters and business and stuff and relationships not working out. And we've been able to go through those trials and tribulations and have success and experience failure and still been able to go through the thick and thin of it without any type of issue, well, without any major type of issue or severing of the relationship.
Yeah. Yeah. That's not always easy when you're in business with family and working through that, especially your dad. And I know, I think you were telling me that, you know, you started in shops around 2008 working part-time and then 2017 became a partner, but it wasn't always a bed of roses. Can you walk us through 2017 and what that looked like for you becoming a partner?
Well, I mean, I want to start with 2008, really, because when I started, I was a C-Tech and I very quickly moved up to the front. Well, we all know what happened in 2009 and 2010. We had very big issues and recessions and that type of stuff. So I learned how to sell service in probably the worst time to learn how to sell automotive service. And I think that's unique because I think some of those times and some situations are starting to return in some areas. And we've gone through the COVID stuff and now it's getting back hard to be able to sell service and to do things the proper way and run your shop the proper way. So I'm pulling a lot on that experience that my dad put me into at that point in time. The trials and tribulations, you know, obviously we grew a shop, a single store up until 2017. I became a partner. We continued to grow that single store in 2017 and in 2018. And then in early 2019, jumped into a second store. And then that's where we really started to get some limbs, let's say.
Well, and I think, you know, when you started back at 2008, and I would imagine being in all the different positions and learning each of the things that you had to do in order to run a shop. What was that like? Was there any position that you kind of gravitated towards in the shop itself?
I gravitate towards sales. So the service advising side is definitely where I gravitate towards. And then the operation side is definitely right up there with that for me at this point in time. So if I go in the back of your shop, am I going to be an A-Tech? Am I going to be your lead dia guy? Absolutely not. You do not want me doing that. But I can be a darn good service advisor for you and be a good store manager and a good operations guy.
Well, with that first store, becoming a partner, for you, being a partner with your dad, you even told me, you know, that when you went and switched to having two stores, trying to get another one off the ground, you experienced something with that first store that was pretty catastrophic. Something you didn't expect. Can you talk us through that and what that was like?
Yeah. So unlike a lot of guys that jump into a second store, a decent amount of guys that jump into the second store have a really big first store. And our first store is not very big. It's in a small town. It's 2.72 square miles, two stoplights. It's the same town that I grew up in. Our school is kindergarten through 12th grade in one building. I know everybody in this town. I've been in this town my entire life. I'm raising my kids in this town currently. And when we went to the second store, we decided it would be a good time to remodel the exterior of the first store. So we took all the signage down, took everything down that way. And my parents' lawyer actually called and said, "Hey, I heard around town that your parents are getting a divorce, like, and that you guys were selling. What's going on?" And I'm like,
"Word travels fast. Sums up."
And I'm like, "Oh my gosh!" Like, meanwhile, like the first store is starting to slip, the second store is starting to take off, and Mike and I did not divide and conquer at that point in time. So I put two guys in the first store to run the first store, pulled myself out of the first store, went to the second store to get that off the ground. And lo and behold, we realized real fast we were marketing really far out for the first store. We lost almost $250,000 worth of business to ourselves in that first year to the second store. And I went from having one store doing almost $1.5 million to two stores doing $1.9 million and doubled overhead. So that was fun.
So I got a question, Tony. I got a comment. You got to walk us through. You're the only guy I know in business that calls his dad by his first name all the time, and it cracks me up. Like, all he'll be over there and he'll be like, "Hey, Mike's getting some Kool-Aid," and we're like, "Mike, Mike."
Well, he just
and
said
he,
it.
And he totally he flips. Said, Mike. He did. He totally flips the business hat on and is able to take the dad hat off and the son hat off. So, before we go further, can you just give us a 30-second spiel on, did y'all have a formal conversation, or was this just like, I'm gonna call him Mike behind his back?
No, there's no conversation. I just did it. So,
all right, enough. We can move on. Joking.
No, I think the deteriorating part of the relationship between a father, son, father, daughter and stuff is most of the time the original person in the business, whether that be the father, the son, the daughter, whoever, they are the person that is the worst about shutting work off once they leave work. And especially when I lived in the same house as my dad in like 2008, 2009, 2010, and we're working together, living in the same house still, that was hard.
You didn't share that part. You probably should have shared that part first.
And it became really hard to differentiate, hey, this is dad now, but at work, this is Mike. So yeah. I don't even notice myself doing it anymore. It's so common to me. I mean, you should see people in meetings when we do that with our own people and our own staffs, and I refer to him as Mike. We're standing up there at the front talking, and they're like, "Wait, who are you talking about? Are you talking about Mike over here?" No, Mike right here. And, you know, I think one of the key things that I found in our relationship was it was important to differentiate him as dad at work if I needed to, or dad at home all the time, and Mike at work if I needed to remain that professional side of things. Now, I will say there's times where even to this day, I'll walk into his office and I'm like, "Hey, I don't need Mike. I need dad." And that tells him switch his mindset, and then we can have a real honest conversation, even if it's in the middle of the workday.
Wow, that's as a father with some young men as sons, I can fully appreciate that you have the maturity to be able to distinguish when which person you need and which role. That's really important.
I still remember the first times I started working with you guys when we had, you know, just some of those. Some of the smallest groups in the very beginning hanging out. And I don't know that there was anybody more hungry than Tony and Mike. I mean, they were just all in. I mean, 100% all in. And it was like you guys at the end of a walk through a desert and you were just getting water like crazy. And then the nutty part was, and this is the part that I thought was so impressive, Jay, they would get water for themselves and then turn around and then stop for themselves and just give it to everybody else. They knew a lot of people. And so they just started encouraging and trying to help a lot of people and almost to a detriment, didn't focus on themselves enough in those early years. Tony, could you talk a little bit about the decision to go to the second store? Because for everyone who doesn't know, your family has a pretty large mini storage business, has, you know, the original shop, et cetera. Your dad was involved in some other things, but to go open a second store was a big deal. It was scary for some of your family members, yourself included. And so whether it be your wife, your dad's wife, siblings, kids, et cetera, Can you walk us through the process of deciding we're going to be an MSO, we're going to be a multi-location business, and what some of those conversations were like, and maybe who was driving that decision or who was hesitant on that decision?
Well, I can tell you my dad and I were driving that decision, and my mother was extremely hesitant in that decision. So getting all three of us on the same page, and I still question whether all three of us are on the same page at this point in time, at all times, but getting us all to agree on the steps that we were doing was important. So I remember, you know, us as men forget a lot of times to take our moms out to lunch, take our moms out to dinner, and do that type of stuff. I hadn't done that in many years. I actually screwed up this last couple of years and hadn't done it in a couple of years again, and just did it here recently. But I remember I took my mom out to dinner at a place down the street from us in a town over from us called Hunters. And we sat at this back table, like in the outdoor area, and in Indiana doing that in like November, sometimes can be very hit or miss weather wise. So it was colder than hell in there. And my mom's a very warm bodied person. So she's like shivering and stuff. And I'm like, all right, this isn't going to be good for this conversation. Like I can remember some of these vivid details. And I'm like, I really want to go to two stores, and I think this is what we need to do for our family. And I think this is what I need to do. And we need to double down in automotive repair at this point in time versus continuing serial entrepreneur businesses outside of automotive repair. At that point in time, we had scaled down to just having the mini storage in the shop. And we just had a real heart to heart conversation. It was fairly emotional. I drew out my plan. Nothing went to my plan that I wrote on the napkin, but I drew out my plan and everything and, you know, sold it, if you will, as best as I could with passion and love to my mother. And she kind of gave her blessing on it at the same time saying, I'm giving you my blessing, but I'm not giving you my blessing, but it sounds like I can't hold you and your father back from this.
Oh,
and we ended up moving forward and, you know, that was probably the hardest part to me of making the jump to MSO, how we structured the deal, how we did everything. We didn't have a lot of risk in that second store. We were able to do that fairly smart in how we built that situation and stuff. And we had very, very good people that we bought the second store from, and it was an A+ location. And we thought that going in that it was an A+ location. It's proven that out later on through owning it. At this point in time, but the people that we bought it from were great. They were a family business, very similar story, had been in, started the same month, the same year that my dad started, owned that shop the entire time, just 35 minutes north of us. And that was really probably the biggest thing for me, Aaron, was having that conversation with my mom and trying to get her on board.
So why was she scared? Why was she hesitant to give you your blessing? Like you're talking about how that was emotional and how she was hesitant. Why?
My mom, a lot of times pulls, especially in business, from more of the negative times. So my mom had always been our financial person, always been our controller, our bookkeeper, our, you know, that person in our business.
She saw the numbers.
Yeah. And as my mom says, you're not really that great of a bookkeeper until you deal with brackets. And my mom had dealt with brackets a decent amount in her life and negative numbers and stuff like that through. You know, you think about going from 1984, and I don't even know them all, through at that point in time, 2018, how many recessions, how many dips in the economy, how many 9/11, 2008, 2009, 2010, how many of those type of things had my mom muscled the store through from the financial side while my dad's sitting up there selling on the front counter? And
well, in brackets, what you're saying is like parentheses. Right?
Yeah.
When you see that at the bottom of the P&L, that means it's negative.
Yes.
And so when you say brackets, she was dealing with a lot of negative numbers for those listening. Negative numbers.
Yeah. And you know, we had plenty of years that were positive numbers too. But she would always go back to, what if it goes back to that? Who's going to do this? Who's going to do the bookkeeping side? Who's going to have the fortitude to push us through from the financial side? Because I'm not a financial guy. My dad's not a financial guy. My dad's a sales guy, as am I. And you know, we got to lean on somebody to be able to do that for us. And I think her biggest fear was she'd have to be pulled back in like she was at that point in time.
Well, and when you Well, that's interesting because that, A, having her pseudo blessing of going into the second store, but then experiencing what you did where you struggled with the first store, did that pressure, you know, that weight of knowing, hey, I've got my mom on, we're moving forward with this. How did that work out for you guys with your mom and everything when that was happening, that challenge? How did y'all work through that?
That was more difficult because my dad's an optimist. My mom's probably more of a pessimist, and I'm definitely in between. I can sway one direction or the other. So it's especially when store one, the stuff started hitting the fan, and I was concentrating on store two and really growing store two. And that conversation came down basically through my dad and my mom sitting on one side of our conference room table in the original store, and me sitting on the other side, and me getting basically served with foreclosure paperwork that was drawn up by our lawyer, because the deal that I had was buying the store out with the profits of the original store. And the original store wasn't profiting at that point in time. And they, you know, had some talks with some of their mentors, and he said, what would a bank do? And to my dad, and well, a bank would foreclose on the deal because payments hadn't been made in 3 or 4 months. And so that was a wake up call. That was the time that, you know, was really like, all right, what's the plan? What are we going to do? What's the clear objective here? And how are we going to tackle this? But how are we going to do it together as well? Because we're still partners in this. So the plan basically was Mike went to the second store, managed the second store from the background. I went back into the first store after basically serving in the DM role, had to go right back to the front counter, had to jump on in as a service advisor, as a store manager, had to jump in and reteach safety inspections and all the basic stuff that we had forgotten basically in the first store through the transition. And that's pretty much how we pulled the ship out at that point in time.
And I got to brag on Tony. There's been several instances where Tony has all of a sudden found himself on the edge of a cliff, and he stepped up to the challenge every single time. And what I've noticed about you, Tony, is that as you've grown in business, I've seen you hesitate less and less and be less afraid of that next level. You're like, okay. And you just step up, step up, step up. But that was one of the first, right? And I think that what was so powerful about that particular period of time, everybody has to remember that you guys had this crazy dual relationship, kind of like you do now, dad and Mike. So your dad had to be your partner. He had to be your dad. He had to be Mike, but he also had to be the bank. And when he was the bank role, he had to jerk your chain a little bit. And so the two of you having to manage all the multiple hats, if you will, and come to that conclusion of this is how we're going to fix this was incredibly powerful. But I'll tell you the biggest thing, it was mature. And so I think a lot of people don't talk about this, but I believe personally the only way you can go MSO is if there is a certain level of maturity between yourself, partners, husbands and wives, employees, et cetera, or you're not going to be able to handle it. I mean, going MSO is like getting drunk in a lot of ways. And that, you know,
for a guy who drinks Sprite, this is a shocking revelation right now.
It is. And so, you know, if you're the type of person that is a nice guy, when you get drunk, all of a sudden you're like, wow, they're a real nice guy. It exposes it. And MSO's like that. You find out real quick what somebody's made of. Everything that is there is now revealed when you go the MSO route.
Yeah.
So can you talk a little bit about how maybe you learned about yourself or felt yourself changing or felt yourself developing as a person through the process of going from store one to store two and this wake-up call? Because I want to go on, you know, after this and hear about the other stores, but can you talk us through that process of becoming single location Tony to multi-location Tony, humbling yourself, putting yourself on the front counter?
Well, probably my biggest issue, and I think a lot of nice guys' biggest issues, is I like to help people. So a lot of us got into this because we wanted to help people. We wanted to fix cars. We wanted to take that pain away from somebody. And probably one of my biggest issues going MSO is I continue to want to help people. So one of my other friends at one point in time said, would you rather make an employee cry or a wife cry or your wife cry? And I got to think about, would I rather make my dad cry, my mom cry, my wife cry, or the employee cry? And so many times, and I feel this pain over and over again because I continue to do this to myself, and it's probably one of my worst traits, is I'll give an employee so much rope and chance after chance after chance instead of pulling the trigger quickly or holding quick accountability. And that's something, you know, I've had to get a lot better at really, really fast, especially in this last transition. Because, you know, in two stores, for the most part, you can still muscle two stores. So especially if they're small stores, and we didn't have huge stores, and I could go in and I could muscle those two stores. And I found that out pretty quick after I went back on the front counter of the first store. I'm like, all right, Dad, get out of the way. I can go muscle that second store. Give me a VPN connection and I can be in both Mitchell systems at the same time and I can do this and I'll just muscle it. And Ford calls me and I started doing some of that. And I started making sales calls for the other store while I was at the other store and doing a whole bunch of that. And that's, you know, really probably the second part of that, of when I started to take that back over, is I just started to muscle those two stores. When you go three stores or four stores or five stores, you can't do that anymore.
Zone defense, baby.
It is, in theory, impossible. So, yeah.
So, you know, as you're bouncing through all this and you're making this transition, I think it's super interesting. You're talking about who you're making cry, who you're not. But what are you really saying? You're really saying, who am I going to hold accountable?
Yeah.
And, you know, what I have discovered over and over, the quicker you hold an employee accountable when they start their employment, the more likelihood they will make it. If you take an employee that you hire, let's do an example. You hire a guy named Bill. Bill starts, and Bill, you know, really, he respects you in the beginning, but 2 weeks in, he starts misbehaving and does for a year. In 12 months, you try to do your best to get this guy to perform, hold him accountable, have conversations, and do all the stuff. It's almost impossible to turn him around. But in that first 2 weeks, if you start setting him down while he still respects you in the beginning, when he's a little afraid, if you will, because he doesn't have another job lined up. Remember, when he chose you, he told everybody else no. And then he chose you. But in that first 2 weeks, if you do it, the difference is insane. So for just a hot second here, can you just hit on the difference that you have felt going forward as you became a more aggressive leader and how you were able to get people to fall in line? Because I think I've watched you change tremendously, but I think that's a piece that a lot of people could relate to and understand how you pull off that transformation of going from being slow to holding somebody accountable to being quick to holding somebody accountable.
Well, and I think that goes back to probably my one superpower, which is consistency. And I don't do a lot of things flashy. I don't do a lot of things, you know, you don't see me go from 0 to 100 miles an hour real fast. I'm kind of like, as another mentor of mine says, I'm kind of like a diesel truck. I'm not the sports car. I'm going to plow through things and I'm going to constantly go forever. Now I might try to run like a sports car and then that about kills me. But I think that starts with consistent conversations. And so some of the things that we've done here recently is we've put in goal sheets for every single employee that they wrote in their handwriting what their goals were for the next 3 months. We did self-evaluation forms for all managers to where they did self-evaluations in their own handwriting for where they're at. And I pull those back out very often and have them re-update those and do that type of stuff. We've also gone in and put in basically performance enhancement reviews to where, or performance improvement reviews to where an employee, if they're not meeting those goals that they wrote down, within two pay periods that they're going on a performance improvement plan and we're going to work on this step and this step and this step, and we're going to break those goals down even further. That has probably been learned a lot more as we've gone to 3, 4, and 5 stores. It's probably been learned more in the last 3 months, 4 months with the scale that we've had and the explosive growth that we had. And I think Aaron's 100% right. If you hold somebody accountable within those first 2 weeks, to maybe a month, you're going to set the precedent for what their tenure of employment is going to be for the rest of the time. If you let Bill get away with 12 months worth of bad behavior, and then you go in and you try to fix Bill, you've got maybe a 20% chance of keeping Bill at that at most. And most of the time, Bill's going to walk out and get mad and leave, and or you're going to get mad and fire Bill, and it's just not going to be a good situation.
Well, and you hit on something that's really key and important I want to make sure we highlight is two things, consistency and communication. And I find that in management, with people are going to pick up on your consistency no matter if you're consistent or not. And so it's up to you to determine what is your cadence, what is your consistency. And as a manager, you owe it to them because they're going to pick it up regardless of whether or not you do it. And the fact that you are consistent and you do communicate, I mean, we talked about this, good times, bad times, it doesn't matter. You have to communicate. You know, as you're navigating rough waters, you have to say, we're going through rough waters. Here's what we're going to do to move forward. As you're coming into it, hey, you're not performing. Here's what you're going to do to be better, because I want to see you succeed and be with us in 5 years. You know, yes. That communication and that consistency is absolutely key. And if you're not doing it, they're going to figure out that's your consistency.
Yeah, 100%. And then when you go in there and you try to communicate, they're like, I don't want this poured over me. I don't like how I feel right now, and I want out of here. So
yeah, they're going to say, that's not the Tony I know. You're not being consistent right now.
Yeah.
You don't normally do that.
Yes. Yeah. 100%.
Yeah. And I think the other thing that's really interesting, I mean, you have a lot of fortitude. You're consistent. You're that diesel engine, right? You were talking about, but you were also telling me you're not a rah-rah guy. But you've realized the power and the value of setting goals and not vision statements per se, but there are certain things in the culture. You've blown up in terms of adding stores. You've gone, 45 people now from 15 or 14, whatever it was. And so you've learned a lot that, hey, you've got to quickly weed out the good from the bad, the okay from the great. You've set some goals. What are the things and what are those for your teams? How do you set that standard and how do you evaluate great people?
Yeah, I mean, so for us, like I said, I'm not a big rah-rah guy. I wasn't a big believer of core values and vision statements and that type of stuff. Still don't have a vision statement, technically, at this point in time. Sorry.
We'll check in again in 2 weeks. We'll see what happens.
We'll hold you accountable.
Yeah. We did put in core values, and I talked with a bunch of different people because I'm like, all right, I don't want to write a Hallmark card. You know, and I feel like so many times that stuff is like Hallmark cards. And that's not what I want to do. So I talked with a couple of people, and one of my friends, Luke Walker, probably had some of the best ones. So I stole a decent amount of his, because I'm like, all right, that fits a lot of what I do and that fits my core values. And so hustle, humble servant's heart, passion for excellence. And I got to look, positive attitude, no whiners allowed are our 5 core values. And I'm like, that fits me. And so I started thinking about that, and I'm like, well, that fits that person, and that fits that person, and that fits that person that's been with us for 13 years. And so I'm like, those need to be our core values. And so yes, then we started.
Let me repeat those, because you rushed through them pretty quick. Those are really good. Hustle, humble servant's heart, passion for excellence, positive attitude, and no whiners allowed. I love the last one.
Yeah. I wanted to make the last one a little more four-letter word-ish, but I figured that wasn't going to look good on a wall. So,
So Tony, you've written me a couple Hallmark cards, so I would disagree with that statement. I think you're a very good author. You've said some very profound statements to me and been very encouraging. Walk us through the craziness of going from 2 stores to where you are today, the time frame and the timeline, and just kind of very high level, the negotiation of the deals, the fear, the excitement, everything that happened. Walk us through that real quick.
So we had 2 stores in 2021, started negotiating on store 3 from a single owner, and then store 4 and store 5 from a single owner. So 4 and 5 were owned by one guy. We ended up closing on store 3 in September of 22. Opened that basically October of 22. It's a big shop. It's by an airport. It's on the fringe of a probably not so good neighborhood, but on the fringe of a really good neighborhood. It's a beautiful shop. So 13,000 square foot shop. It was underperforming. It's doing better now. It's not quite to where I want it, but it's getting there. So we started negotiating on that store and ended up closing that deal. Like I said, I took that over in October of 22. At the same time, we were negotiating on store 4 and store 5. So Mike was negotiating on store 3. I was negotiating on store 4 and store 5. We ended up closing on store 4 and store 5 in December. Took possession of those January 20th. Those were two They had been long standing MSOs and brake and muffler shops, and they had not had a lot of TLC in them. Every single hoist was from 1993, just had outdated equipment, old, nasty, grungy, smoked in typical shops. So took over January 20th with store 4, renovated that entire shop, floors, hoists, equipment, new lights, new walls, new paint, new everything, new office, command center, two-stage counter, all of that stuff. Flipped that store, had that store open by February 13th. Had to do some final finish in there for probably the next 7 days. That store had never done more than $40,000 in a month. In month one, in March, that store did $97,000. And then I started after we probably finished up there by the end of February, started March 1st, renovating store 5. Store 5 was a complete gut job, gut of plumbing, had no functioning drains in the floors. Those were all capped off, had to go map those, figure all that out. Was on a well, had city water, figured out that we didn't have the budget to be able to connect to city water because we would have had to shut down 3 major lanes of a major highway, but had to do total gut job there in complete totality as well. Got that store pretty much open by about May 1st. That store did not take off as well. That store had a little bit worse reputation and a lot less going on in it. We're still trying to get that store up. That's where I've, get into running out of bench strength. But that store probably was the store that I opened prematurely and stuff. All while I was doing that, we decided that it was time to expand store 2. And we bought the restaurant next door to store 2, tore the restaurant down and put a 60 by 80 addition on store 2 that was about a small 5-bay store to make it a 12-bay store in the same time frame. So store 2 finally got occupancy in July of 23.
What is mom saying?
Yeah, that's what I was about to say. What lunch did you take mom to at that point?
That was a lot of conversation, more so actually from my dad, because I think she thought my dad had completely lost his mind. So yeah. And she still questions it, but yeah. So that was a difficult transition there as well. Just in that, honestly, through all of that, I never took her out to lunch. And that's the mistake that I hinted at earlier. So I didn't take her out to lunch until probably beginning in December this last year. And then still had to have some hard conversations with both partners and thereafter with trying to get these stores off the ground. Because in theory, if you really think about it, we opened store 3, October of 22, opened store 4, February 13th of 23, opened store 5, May 1st of 23, got occupancy for store 2, July 1st-ish, somewhere in there, of 23. So that's 4 stores in theory within less than a year's time.
Wow. Bro.
Amazing.
Bro. All right. So you opened all these stores. Walk us through your corporate office and how you were setting it up, because all of a sudden, running 2 stores, you can do that with 1 bookkeeper. All of a sudden you got 5 stores. You're having to figure out corporate fees and you're having to figure out, however you call it, but you're having to figure out insurance, payroll, everything at a much larger level. Can you walk us through what was going on behind the scenes to support these 5 stores?
Well, thank God we came really close right before COVID opening store 3. And if we would have done it, it definitely would have been premature at that point in time. But what it did is it made us focus back on the corporate office when we only had 2 stores. So we pretty much built out most of our corporate office roles and responsibilities. How the store's behavior was going to be able to scan documents and where we were going to upload them to, and how all those processes were going to work at the store level to be able to get them to the bookkeeping office. And then we were able to, even at 2 stores, and obviously we were sacrificing debt while doing this, but we were able to build out our entire corporate office. So I didn't have to do a lot right at the beginning of taking on these stores with the corporate office, because we had already built a decent amount of that out. What I didn't plan for was things like how long payroll was going to take, because I had 2 stores running with multiple different pay plans in front and back of the house, and multiple different levels of flat rate, multiple different levels of GS pay plans, and multiple different levels of FCA pay plans and service advisor pay plans. And so about the 4th or 5th time that we did payroll at 5 stores, and it took us almost 2 days to do payroll. I'm like, look, something's got to change. So we had to go through and basically reevaluate everybody's pay plan and get the pay structures very, very similar to be able to narrow that down. I had to rewrite our entire employment manual because I knew that we were approaching 50 employees. So in the first 5 months of 2023, rewrote our entire employment manual, our entire employee handbook. So we had FMLA policies and procedures in there and had all the stuff that we needed for the size that we were going to. Had to go renegotiate our health insurance stuff. That was a nightmare too, because they're looking at us. You only had 12 people on the policy last year, but yeah, I got 40 people now and I got 40 people who want to be on it. Well, we can only give you the price of 12 people. Well, that's not going to work at 40 people. I'm not going to get 40 people on it. So I got to get you to give me a better price. Yeah, you know, doing all that negotiation at the same time was a lot. So while I had the corporate office structure down, then some of those things started leaching in when we started getting to the level that we're at now. That really took a lot of time and probably took our eye off the ball in some areas that we should have concentrated more on.
Good stuff, dude. So as you're going through this, realizing things like payroll, you know, it is crazy. A lot of people will go MSO and they're paying every Friday, or they're going MSO and they're paying, you know, one guy, if he hits this many hours, this much above, this many hours, this much above. And, or if they sell this much gross profit, they get an extra kicker for this. And I'm like, you cannot scale doing that. You cannot scale. And so as you're simplifying, it sounds like you're figuring this stuff out. You're working on the scale piece. How did you go about tackling the stores and dealing with operational inefficiencies, operational problems, you know, breakage, et cetera? You got three new stores, all of them with three different issues. How'd you figure out which store to tackle first and work your way down?
So the stores that I tackle first are always the easiest stores. So what store can I go in and make the most money right now? So like store five right now is not a huge focus of mine. It's doing what it's doing. It's, you know, minimally losing money at this point in time, every once in a while, minimally breaking even or making a little bit of money. But I know if I go focus on store two, and I know if I go focus on store three and store four, those are the stores that I can turn the tide in the fastest and make the most money and go quicker. So I really have focused on store four and store two, number one, and then I focused on store three is the number two store. Store one stayed pretty consistent throughout the entire time, so I haven't had to put much focus in there at this point in time. But like I said, I don't do much focus on store five.
So what advice would you give to a budding MSO owner? And they hear stories about, you know, we have multiple stores, some are crushing it, some are losing money. That's a common thing in MSO. And when you're a single store operator, you can focus on one store and always make money. So what advice would you give somebody like that who's just trying to figure out which store they should pour into? How do they know a particular store is easier than another store?
I look at location and staff. So what store has the best staff that's underperforming, and what store is the best location? So, and for me, that's always been store two. That's still the best location. That's still got the best staff. And I know I can turn that store up with minimal effort faster and make more money faster there. Then I can maybe go to a B location that I have and turn that store up. So if I can get the staffing to a point where I have the basics covered and the staff in a store that is maybe not doing as well, then I'm going to leave that there. I'm going to put one of my other guys kind of over that, pseudo district managing that. And I'm going to go focus on the heavy hitting stores that I can go net $100,000 a month and make that up for the store that's losing $10,000 a month. So.
And how long would you do that for? If somebody's sitting here going, man, that's crazy. Why do you got the other store? It's losing money. So how long would you do that for before you would finally fix the last store?
I'd do it until basically the store that I'm jumping into is at the point that I want it to be at. So if I got to keep that store, it losing $10,000 a month for 6 months, but I can get the other store to go from 70 to 80 to 90 to $100,000 worth of net, and it takes me 6 months to build across that, I would do that. I'd do that deal all day long. And then go back into the fifth store once I got that second store, you know, net $100,000.
Wow. Good advice.
Well, and you're probably netting out longer term in that shorter time, being able to turn the low hanging fruit around. you're generating that where you know you have a long-term problem that you're solving for, but your net gain on that one's going to be smaller over a longer period of time. It just makes total sense.
Yes, 100%. So
interesting. And I know one of the things you were telling me in the things that you have to do and the stuff that you have to accomplish with these stores and just continue with the staffing and working on improving the people and focusing on those values is continuing to move things around and continue to build that bench up. And I think that you highlighted that when you were growing, one of the things you did, you ran out of a bench.
Yeah, the bench got empty real fast going through the growth that we went through. So by the time I hit store five, I didn't have anybody on the bench. You got to always have a bench worth of talent sitting there. And then if somebody leaves, very rarely in automotive do you have contracts. So every single employee that you have is working on a 2-week notice, if that, in today's society. So if you don't have a bench, you don't plug somebody else in, especially being MSO, you don't have anything. You lose that ATEC tomorrow and they decide to walk out 3 days after that, then, and you have no bench strength, you're going to suffer in that store for a little bit, especially if it's a small store with a single ATEC.
That is such a powerful statement. What you just said, everybody that's working for you is on a 2-week notice. Mm-hmm. That's a crazy statement. And it's true. And that's if they're polite.
Yeah.
It could be 4 days, 3 days.
Yeah.
Good point, man.
Well, it also leans back to his whole point of consistency and making sure you're tackling that stuff with them because, you know what, man, at the end of the day, yeah, that 2-week, it's there behind the scenes and you've got to make those decisions that's right for the family and for the business. And also, I mean, you've also got to make the right decision by them. So that way you're moving them along. If it's not a good fit, it's not a good fit, move along, like find something that's even better for them somewhere else and also better for you.
Yeah. And I think that's hugely important too. I contemplated on if I tell this story or not, but I'm going to. I recently had an ex-employee reach out to me that hasn't worked for us for probably 4 years. And I don't know that I conducted myself in the best manner 4 years ago when he gave his 1-day notice, and I may or may not have pushed his toolbox in the parking lot. But
we'll edit that part out, man. It's okay. Yeah.
What was interesting was he sent me a Facebook message and he said, "Hey, I hope all is well with you. I want to let you know that you were right about me." And I'm thinking to myself, like, how do I respond to this? Like, what's this about? I responded, I said, "Well, that was many years ago. I don't know that I conducted myself in the best manner when you left. I apologize for that. I hope all is well with you. And obviously I don't remember what I said to you, but I hope it led to something that proved results for you." And he responded back. He's like, "Yeah, 100% did. I'm out of the industry now. I'm doing a lot better. You had told me that I needed to go get a second opinion about my mental health and get off some of the medication possibly that I was on. And I went and I got off that medication, got a second opinion, found out I was misdiagnosed and I'm doing much better in my life and with my family and everything else. Because of those words that you said, you were the only person that talked to me in that manner." I did that on his exit when I didn't conduct myself all that well. That was pretty powerful to me to hear that. Yeah. So it's,
Dude, making an impact.
Isn't it crazy? Sometimes you don't even realize the power you have and the power or influence you have in somebody else. And then when that happens, you're like, "Oh my gosh, I'm a bigger deal than I thought." Yeah. You were a big deal to that guy. So Tony, somebody's listening. They got 2 stores. They're about to go to 5. What would you do differently if you were going to do the exact same stores, the exact same deal? What would you do differently if you got to hit a redo button right now?
Number one, as long as they're not remodeling their second store, they can probably make that jump, but they need to do it slow, i.e. it needs to happen over the course of a year to a year and a half. So I probably, thinking about my timeline, the October opening of store 3 was fine. Store 4 being small and opening in February was fine. I would not have opened store 5 until probably the 3rd or 4th quarter of last year. I would have left that store dark and negotiated that store to where I could have left it dark and remodeled it a lot slower, spent a lot less cash through that course of time and just did it a little bit slower.
So what I hear you saying is you now know that store 5 was going to lose money. So why get in a hurry to go lose money? But what if store 5 would have taken off? You know, that's what everybody does going into this. They don't open store five thinking it's going to lose money. They open store five thinking, if I can hurry up and get this thing open, it's going to start paying me.
Well, and I think
so.
I think that's where, like in my situation, knowing store five in the area that it's in an area that's being revitalized right now. It's got a lot of traffic, but it's got a lot of traffic driving by. It doesn't have a lot of people stopping. So it's got the traffic count you look for. It's got the houses that you look for, but it's still being revitalized. It's got bridges coming across to get back to that main road and a lot of stuff. So I think you got to look at your location side of things. So if you buy these stores, store three, store four, store five separate, but store five's the bottom location, that needs to open third. It may still be called store five. I have plenty of friends that are like, hey, I got store six and it's an empty piece of dirt. And I just opened store seven. And so store five may open in the third slot, but if the location is phenomenal, I would open best location first. I would open the next best location second. And then if you've got a B location, I would say B location for last.
Very, very good advice. So it sounds like you're basically saying you're not worried about just sitting on a store if you have to for a while, paying on an empty building.
No, I'm paying on an empty building right now. So,
and everybody here, I hope you're hearing that piece. There's something to that, and knowing your bandwidth, your team's bandwidth, and where you're going with things, I think that we all have to wrap our head around and go, okay. I got to know my limitations, know my team's limitations, and know when to pull back and not push them to the brink.
100%. And I think, you know, especially when you have that amount of explosive growth, you got to be ready for this. So I looked around at one point in time, and I think it was 62 or 64% of my staff had been with me less than a year.
Mm.
So, and when you look around at that, you better be ready to basically open up your own coaching company within your own business, because you need to be training your rear end off in order to get those stabs up to snuff. And I mean, we've had to do that. So we've had to close all five stores down for a day and do a training day. We've had to do multiple evening service advisor training events. We've had to do multiple tech events. You know, we've had to really, really train. And I'm not talking about bringing outside trainers in like, hey, this is how this scanner works, anything like that. It's like, no, this is our key to key process, or our call to call process. This is what you do when a customer comes in the door. This is how you check in a car. This is how you do a safety inspection. This is how we operate here. So I'm not talking about sending your training side to a Napa training class, not to diminish Napa training classes. They're good classes. But you got to train on your operations and your policies and procedures and your standard operating procedures to get that into your staff when you're at that level too.
Well, and you know, people don't get this, but if you have 10 employees and you have one new employee show up, out of those 10 employees, if nine are original and the one new one shows up, there are nine people there that are able to say, that's not how we do it. This is how we do it. Right. And they're able to continually help that person along. A lot of people take that for granted. They actually think their own influence is greater than it is, not realizing it's the rest of the team influencing that new employee.
Correct.
They think, oh man, I'm amazing. I'm the best leader ever. When in actuality, the team is helping bring that person up to the next level. And then it becomes incredibly evident when you go open a brand new store and there's one person that knows. And so then we have nine new people and one person that knows. There is no, hey, this is how we do this here. And so you had to do that.
Yeah.
So I think that's incredibly powerful for others to pick up on.
Yeah, that nine new people left untouched will create their own culture circle.
Yes.
Yes, they will.
And it will be whatever culture they came from.
Yep, that's right.
And you don't want that culture.
No.
That's why they left.
Yeah. Yep.
Well, Tony, I've taken a ton of stuff away from this. I love the consistency, the communication, the fact that, you know, the corporate office structure you had going out of shop two, just the things that you put into practice and learned over this. It's been really good to hear from you. Is there any last thing you'd like to say to your team, say out there, say to somebody listening, a little motivation?
My favorite quote is from Cal Ripken, the baseball player, for those that are not sports fans. And it's, don't get too high with the high or too low with the lows.
Good stuff, man.
Love it. Well, thanks so much, Tony.
All right. Thank you, guys.
Appreciate you, man.